Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Almost Famous, the podcast where I meet other people with famous family members and discuss how that has affected their journeys through life. My guest today is actress Lucy Bryars.
My dad was in the swimming pool. I'm an actress, went, Richard Bryars, this is your life. And I threw a complete queenie.
Since studying at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, Lucy has appeared on television in shows including Pride and Prejudice, Silent Witness, Ashes to Ashes, 2012, and The Thick of It.
And I remember a girl at school saying, oh, do you have goats in your garden? I said, it's a TV show. No, we don't have goats in our garden.
In films including Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa, and on stage in the West End and Broadway in Showboat, Wolf Hall, and Bring Up the Bodies, to name but a few. Lucy is the daughter of the late actor Richard Bryars, CBE.
He was good fun to be with. My poor mum was kind of like the bad cop, and he was the good cop.
Richard was perhaps best known for his role as Tom Good in the 1970s BBC sitcom The Good Life, but he was a prolific actor, having appeared in films including Much Ado About Nothing, A Chorus of Disapproval, and Hamlet.
When I was a teenager, he would allow me to come and hang out in the wings of whatever West End Theatre he was doing a show in, which was, of course, totally ridiculous, because he'd never wanted me to be an actor, and then would go, come and partake of this drug.
Richard was part of Kenneth Branagh's Renaissance Theatre Company, appearing on stage in the title roles of King Lear and Uncle Vanya, and throughout his career, Richard was a regular on the small screen, including roles in Ever Decreasing Circles, Monarch of the Glen, Torchwood, and of course as narrator of the 1970s kids cartoon series Rhubarb and Custard. And I heard a little laugh at that one from our guest today. Lucy, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, considering it's Monday morning.
Yes, it was Monday morning, and that's why it took me 19 times to get through that intro, but we'll edit it so it doesn't seem like anything went awry.
Absolutely.
I wanted to start just by asking what it was like growing up with your dad narrating one of the kind of coolest, most popular cartoons around, because 70s was a tiny bit before my time, but I certainly saw lots of reruns of Rhubarb and Custard.
Well, my claim to fame is that I was the first person slash child in this country to see Rhubarb and Custard, because my dad took me to a sound studio in Soho on my 7th birthday and showed me the first two episodes. I thought it was amazing. I mean,
You were a very early focus group.
I'd never seen anything like it, you know. And what I thought was so hilarious about the programming of that cartoon was that it was put at the end of, you know, the kid's kind of TV slot on BBC, which was supposed to be when the kid was kind of, you know, like winding down to go to it. And had this kind of LSD trip going on for, like, I don't know how long each episode is. What is it, 5-6 minutes or something? No, it was great. And, you know, Dad did all the voices and all of that. But it's a very, I'm sure you've had this as well, it's a very interesting thing, because so many times in my life, people have said, what's it like having a famous father? I don't know, because my father was famous from before I was born. So I don't know what it's like to have a famous father. It was just, that was
my
dad.
He was just dad.
It was my dad, and he was well known. So, you know, so yeah, I was aware that he was doing that cartoon and I loved watching it. But as a 7, 8, 9 year old, that's just what your dad does.
But you didn't go into school and say, oh, you have to watch this cartoon, my dad's narrating it, it's amazing, or anything like that?
Lord above, no. I mean, no.
I'm not sure that I would.
It never occurred to me.
But
to
I only
do that.
Asked because I'm not sure that I wouldn't have done. It was such kind of a cool thing. Well, I guess my equivalent of it is if I'd gone to school and it turns out that my dad had been the voice of Bart Simpson.
Oh, well, no, that would. Yeah, I think that would be different, actually. And in fact, The Simpsons was one of my father's favourite cartoons. He watched it pretty much every afternoon, especially when he was ill in the last few years of his life. I also remember him watching it. He went over to Australia to do Peter Pan. He made a film, Peter Pan. And I went over there at one point to just, you know, hang out in the Palazzo Versace. I mean, why wouldn't you? The only six-star hotel in the world or something, ludicrous. Anyway, and what I love, this is what I loved about my father, was that he was in this apartment in the Palazzo Versace, and every afternoon he would watch The Simpsons like he was at home, you know.
That's so cool. And I think, just to show you some of my deep, deep knowledge, I think the Palazzo Versace is the hotel that they use for I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
It certainly is. Yeah, it certainly is. I've heard that one as well. So, yeah, I think if my dad had been voicing Bart Simpson, I possibly would have actually tried to drop that into a conversation. But yeah. Rhubarb and Custard, cult though it is perhaps not on the same level.
Well, I think you're doing a disservice to Rhubarb
Sorry.
And Custard.
Soz, and everyone.
If we ever get the daughter of the maker of Rhubarb and Custard in, I will make sure to tell her what you said. We usually ask the same question first up,
right.
But I wanted to talk about Rhubarb and Custard. But
okay.
I wanted to know what you thought of your intro and what Richard would have thought of his, do you think? Do you think he maybe would have been disappointed that we left a few things out? There was just so much stuff.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, what can you do? You can't put... How long was he a professional, like a performing, like professional actor? 50 years, 50-odd years. No, I think he would have liked it because, you know, it mentioned the stuff he is very well known for, but also the fact that for a wonderful reason of Ken Branagh coming into his life, his career took a very different turn in his 50s, which was brilliant because he had kind of hit a sort of wall in terms of being very typecast. And no, I was very happy with mine, darling. You mentioned Broadway and the West End. I'm happy.
I'm right. I mean,
it's all good.
And as an actress yourself, is being typecast the almost, other than being unemployed, you know, quite a frightening prospect? One of the most frightening prospects?
Gosh, I think you almost have to police that yourself. I mean, what Dad was brilliant at is he was consistently great at getting himself out of his comfort zones. And I think I learned a lot from that, watching him do that. And of course, in a way, the most powerful thing an actor can have is the power to say no to a job, actually. So I always try to find a way of being financially independent of the industry in a weird way. So I was very lucky. I still do voiceovers, but I went through a phase of doing like loads. So financially, I was really fine. I was okay. And I have day jobs. I've had two day jobs since I was like in my mid-20s that I still do. I think that's important because otherwise, you are going to get typecast and you will just go, oh yeah, great, that's another. And for me, that's not why I want to be an actor. I want to be an actor so, you know, I challenge myself. Of course you are going to. I'm never going to be. I was never the ingenue. You know, I was always the strange best friend. And I'm now in a sort of position in my early 50s. I'm now going into sort of like the doer, housekeeper, scary police DCI area of the industry, which I'm thoroughly enjoying, I have to say.
I hope to see you in line of duty.
I'd love to do that.
Oh my God.
But I think that's important.
Interesting that you brought up your day jobs, I think, because we're recording this in early November, and it was actually only a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if you saw this, that a former EastEnders actress was publicly shamed for working a day job as a security guard in a supermarket, I think. Definitely keen to get your opinion on that, because that was a really shocking piece of what I think is a classic example of what modern day journalism seems to all be about and what social media jumps on and things. Awful.
Well, I think it's that thing, isn't it, of people assuming that because she's been a regular in a soap opera, she's going to be sort of, you know, hanging around in a jacuzzi, sort of like living the life of Riley. No, you know, the minute a job finishes, you know, pretty much, unless you've managed to save some money out of it, you're going to be going, oh, okay, well, and good on her. I mean, yeah, great. We all have to do it. I would say 98% of actors have to have day jobs and have to have other ways of earning money. What is shameful about that? You know, that's just part of what we do and how we survive, you know. So, no, I thought that was appalling.
And I think that ties in also with what people assume it must be like to grow up with a famous person as your parent. Did you find that people naturally assume that your life was a lot more that you're a lot richer in essence than you were, or that you had more opportunities than everybody else?
I think people, well, there were two things. I remember when The Good Life was really kind of at the top of its game, so to speak, and I was, again, sort of 7, 8, 9. And I remember a girl at school saying, "Oh, do you have goats in your garden?" And I just thought, what a stupid thing to say, even at like the age of 8. I was like, you know, and I felt like saying to her, I said, "It's a TV show. No, we don't have goats in our garden.
Our goats are at our farm."
Absolutely. That's on our estate. No. I think people did think that, you know, I lived in a very glamorous house, and you know, my parents were both Blitz kids, as I call them. You know, they'd grown up in the war, and my father especially had had a very kind of financially unstable childhood. I grew up in a very nice, lovely house in West London, but, you know, nothing was repaired or redecorated until it was absolutely, you know, beyond, you know, like either beyond repair, or my parents would go, "Oh yeah, that room does look a bit shoddy now," you know. So, and I'm the same. I mean, I will absolutely kind of like get everything out of whatever I have until it's broken, and you know. I lived in a kind of bohemian, shabby chic. Yeah. That's what I would describe myself as.
Gone with you into later
totally.
Life.
Totally. All my furniture is secondhand. It spans from sort of 1890s through to about 1970s. I love all that. I go round to friends' houses, you know, and they look astounding, you know, like they're just in House and Gardens. And I do come back to my flat sometimes and go, I do sort of live sort of in a hovel, but but I like my hovel. So, you know, there we are.
No, I think there are a West London hovel, though,
still.
A West London hovel,
yes, exactly. But I don't know. I think there are more important things to worry about, really.
You mentioned that your dad was really excellent at making sure he was never in his comfort zone.
Mm.
And I've also read a lot that he was very open about his battle with nerves when acting as well. So those things, to me, don't seem to tally up. Like, almost testing himself despite knowing how much it would affect him.
I know. I think he was a risk taker. And in fact, I didn't fully appreciate this until I was working with James Hogg, who wrote his my father's posthumous biography. Mm-hmm. And it was only working with James that I absolutely started to go, oh yeah, my dad really did take risks all the time, despite the fact that, you know, it would put him through intense nerves. I remember Ken Branagh saying to me that, like, on the press night of King Lear, Dad had this entrance where, you know, he was standing behind these kind of massive double doors, and, you know, the doors opened and there was King Lear. And Dad had also broken his ankle through rehearsals, so was performing with a plaster cast and crutches. Ken said he was visibly shaking, you know, visibly, like, absolutely wrought with nerves. What drives somebody to do that? I think because his creative soul wanted to keep pushing himself. And that is, to me, incredibly admirable, and something that I try to also do in my career, of going, do I want to play that part, or would I? My dad always used to say to me, keep yourself available. That's better. It's better being unemployed for a bit than doing a job you don't want to do. If you can help, you know, if you can help it. If, you know, obviously, you know, if you absolutely desperately need the cash, of course, you have to do it. But if you can avoid that, then keep yourself available for the jobs that are going to make your heart sing, really.
For me, that makes him an artist, because,
it's
the same for me as all the bands that I love the most. So Radiohead, who will consistently reinvent themselves.
Yeah.
And of course, they could have made 6 different versions of OK Computer, their most successful album, and made, I dare say, a lot more money in a lot shorter space of time. But they're artists, so they have to keep reinventing themselves. I think that's really impressive, especially not something you see that regularly in actors, I personally don't find. I wanted to ask how you felt when we first asked you to appear on the podcast, because, you know, I find it a fascinating subject, but it's one that not everybody feels comfortable talking about.
No, I just thought the questions were really interesting. So, I was like, oh, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, because it is interesting. It is interesting. And nobody has ever, yes, people have said, you know, what's it like having a famous father? But that's not the same as what the approach you've got. And you know, it is different. It is different growing up with somebody who is in the public eye. And, you know, I used to have this kind of weird fantasy sometimes that I was growing up in a family that was... I hate the word normal.
You're going to say normal, yeah.
I hate that word.
But I totally understand what you mean.
Yeah, I hate it because it's a stupid word. But that was just, you know, I used to have this, I loved the film To Kill a Mockingbird. Great book as well, obviously. And I used to have this kind of fantasy that my dad would be like, you know, Gregory Peck. So he'd come back at 5 p.m. and be at home to kind of read us a bedtime story and stuff like that. Because dad was, you know, his schedule was completely different to ours. You know, he would be asleep when we went to school and he would probably either be already at work or about to go to work because he did so many West End shows when I was a kid, when we got back. So really the only quality time we spent with him was during a summer holiday that we'd booked. Now, I don't in any way mean to then imply that, oh my, that was so terrible. That was my childhood. That's what I was used to. And I guess it's only in retrospect, when you look back, you kind of go, oh, wow, you know, other people had a lot more time with their fathers than we did. But, you know, yeah, so I did have that weird fantasy of like my dad just going, having a 9-to-5 job. Yeah. And that might actually be quite nice.
So
yeah.
The way you talk about it, though, doesn't come across in any way resentful of him always being present.
No.
So in what ways do you think he managed to, as a father, build that relationship with you so that, because I think it's quite easy for kids to rail against that and use it as an excuse. But you don't have any of that resentment at all.
No, I mean, first of all, you know, he, because of his background, I think he was so adamant that his kids would have a financially secure upbringing. And so I always understood that, you know, from a very early age, I guess. He took my sister and I when I must have been about 8. So my sister would have been 12. And he took us to the block of flats where he was brought up, and which are obviously now worth, you know, $500,000 each, you know. But at the time, it was a rented place in, you know, sort of southwest London. And he said to us, I will never forget this. He said, don't ever end up living somewhere like this. As I say now, I'd be like, oh, that's actually quite a nice place, because it had been all, you know, poshed up
and
all that.
It's now a private members bar.
Exactly. You know, I mean, you know, it's kind of, but it was at that time, even in the 1970s, it looked pretty run down, on a busy road, all of that sort of stuff. And I just remember, even at 8, going, oh, okay, all right. And it just, he was driven by that. And so why would I resent that? You know, he was just trying to give us the best life he could possibly give us. And also the time that we did spend with him was quality time. He was hilarious. He was good fun to be with. My poor mum was kind of like the bad cop and he was the good cop. And you know, yeah, I don't know. And also when I was a teenager, he would allow me to come and hang out in the wings of the West End Theatre, whatever West End Theatre he was doing a show in, which was of course totally ridiculous because he'd never wanted me to be an actor, and then would go, come and partake of this drug that I am, you know, doing, you know. So I mean, that just sealed it for me. I was just,
I read that he begged you not to get into acting. So what were his reasonings behind that, and how did it manifest itself?
Begging me not to do it. Yeah. I thought he said, what were his reasons for allowing me into the wings of West End theatres? No idea at all. I think he knew how difficult an industry is, especially for women. I think he wanted me, you know, I went to a very, very posh private school, a very hothouse school where like 85% of my year went to Oxford and Cambridge. And I think my dad wanted me to kind of go to Oxford and Cambridge, be a lawyer or marry somebody very rich. I think there is that element to my dad that he was like, great, I'll send her to this school and, you know, then she'll marry a really rich person. Sadly, it just didn't work out like that. I've told this story so many times and people are always so shocked by it, but I never was, and I always knew what he was doing. He would come and see me in school plays and he'd wait for me afterwards and he'd just come out and he'd just shake his head and go, no. You know, which was basically like, no, you shouldn't be doing this.
I'm aghast. That's
an
amazing story. Well, I think that's an amazing story because
testing my resolve, that's what he was doing.
Which is what you need most as an actor.
Absolutely
is
right.
The thick skin, which makes sense. But as a assuming this was in your teenage years, surely devastating for you.
No.
you were intuitive enough to know what he was doing?
Possibly not that, but I have the personality, quite like my father, actually, that if somebody tells me I can't do something, I will basically go, well, fuck you, I'll do it.
he must have known that then, about you.
I think he probably did. I mean, you know, again, it's a different generation of parenting. You know, thank God. I would hate to be somebody being parented now where most parents are trying to be their child's best friend. I mean, that's not good parenting in my mind. Yeah, it was harsh, but it never affected me. I just thought, well, I'm going to do it. So, despite what you're telling me. And what is amazing is that when I got into drama school, he realised the battle was over, you know. And from that point on, he went, right, I'm going to be your biggest support. I'm going to be your biggest fan. And he did this extraordinary thing when I did a play up at Sheffield Crucible, Cloud Nine, a Carol Churchill play, one of the most beautiful plays ever. And he came to see a matinee, and he and my mum took me out for, like, you know, supper between the shows. And I think it was about 2001, 2002. And he said to me, I'm passing the baton on. And I've got friends who have famous actor parents. None of them have ever done that. And I think, well, to my knowledge, that's a very broad statement, isn't it? But I think that was the most, it was one of the most beautiful moments of my relationship with him, because he said to me, you're doing things up there I couldn't possibly do. Total nonsense, to be frank. But for him to say that to me was amazing. It was an amazing moment in our relationship.
That doesn't sound initially to me like, the fact that you've replied to mentioned that as total nonsense sounds like that's because of the way he's brought you up to not be so arrogant as to think that. Whereas I don't believe for a second that he didn't genuinely mean those words.
I think he did genuinely mean it because, you know, I had to, in that play, I had to be incredibly emotionally vulnerable. And I come from a family, maybe you can tell, that finds that quite difficult. So maybe I think he genuinely meant it. Yeah. He wasn't just being sort of, you know, disingenuous. But it was an amazing moment in our relationship.
And a beautiful thing to cherish, now, especially now that he's gone.
Absolutely.
To remember that he was able to say that for.
Yeah.
I wonder if you have a memory or a concept from when you first realised your dad was famous and not like the other dads.
I do remember him being stopped in the street a lot for autographs from when I was very small.
Yeah.
I just get to get really irritated. I'd be just like, oh, fuck, you know, I want to go to the playground, or I want to, you know, a memory has just suddenly come into my mind. The first time that he had This Is Your Life done for him, we were at Richmond.
He had it done twice, didn't he?
Yeah.
He must be one of the only people to have had it done twice.
Yeah, maybe,
surely.
I think he had it done too early the first time. Or maybe it was because his career took such a different turn, they decided to do it again. But I was 4 or 5, I think, when they did it the first time. And my poor mum had, like, obviously had this whole thing arranged where we were in Richmond swimming baths, and Eamon Andrews came out dressed as a lifeguard. God, it's weird when you say these things because, you know, suddenly you realise your childhood was a bit strange. And with the red book and the microphone. And my dad was in the swimming pool, in the child swimming pool. And Eamon Andrews went, Richard Brower, this is your life. And I threw a complete queenie. I was like, I didn't really understand what was going on. And I wanted my swimming lesson time, whatever it was. And there are photographs of me, how embarrassing is this, in the red book, because that's what the red book is, you know, it's just like photographs of, you know, whatever, the day, of me literally throwing a tantrum because I didn't want to get out of the swimming pool. So, yeah, that's a weird one.
Oh, my God, if that had been in modern day with social media and video and everything, you would have been the star.
Well, yes. I mean, thank God, you know. And that's what we were talking about a bit before we started recording, was that thing of the notion of fame then and the notion of fame now. And I think that's a very, like, important thing to put into the equation of these discussions, because fame then was a kind of much gentler thing for a lot of people, whereas now it's
It's a hiding to nothing in a lot of ways. I feel like I should say, just with my producer hat on, for those of you too young to remember This Is Your Life, This Is Your Life was a show where famous people would be surprised by a presenter, originally Eamon Andrews, but then Michael Aspel, I think, for a number of years did it.
That's right.
And they'd be surprised with a red book in seemingly ever more contrived circumstances. Yes. So your swimming pool one is a great, great story. And there are then some also, you're surprised, and then you're brought to a TV studio where all of your friends and colleagues surprise you and you go through your career and stuff like that.
Yeah.
A great show that will inevitably be brought back and hosted by Ryland Clark, I would have thought.
Oh, that's quite interesting. Yes.
And if that ends up happening, remember who had that idea first. It was me, and it was on this podcast. I wanted to talk a bit about your mum. You have mentioned her, but she was also an actor. And I wondered how she inspired you to get into the acting business and maybe how her support was different from your dad's or anything like that.
I think I had a kind of lesson in, you know, my mum had a very, I guess, normal career for a woman, especially that she was working a lot before she had kids. And then when my sister came along first and then myself 4 years later, I think also because of my father's very, very successful career, I think if they'd both been two normal jobbing actors, she probably would have been able to kind of get more work and do more work. But I think she had to take the choice of, like, I either become pretty much a stay-at-home mum or my kids are going to be brought up by a nanny. So, you know, God love her, she just chose the former. I saw the fallout of that in my teens when my sister left home. And I think my mum, for a while in her mid to late 40s into her 50s, felt like, oh, God, you know, what have I kind of done with my life, in a way, like a lot of people feel in their late 40s to early 50s for different reasons. And I do remember that formed me in a kind of different way in terms of it formed the sort of feminist in me. So she didn't have an effect in terms of career other than giving me a very realistic version of what being an actress is and can be. She also, because of her choices, for me, I kind of went, okay, I don't want that to be my life. I never wanted to be a stay-at-home mum. Mm-hmm. And that is not about, like, it's terrible being a stay-at-home mum. Oh, my goodness me. I just don't have that in me. Yeah. I did want kids. I was just never able to have them. But I think that's right. Because I actually think I would have found it very, I just couldn't have done it. I would have found the routine and the sort of, I would have found it quite dull, I think. It's not a terrible thing to say, but no. I'm going to be very honest. Women aren't allowed to say that, really, are they? But yeah.
Well, I was actually going to ask, do you feel now finally women are getting more opportunities in the acting world, or are you still battling against, is anything changing, basically?
It's a really interesting time right now in the industry. Yes, we are getting more opportunities. There are more male parts opening up to... Oh, that sounds very rude, doesn't it? But anyway, there are more male roles. That's better, isn't it? Opening up for women, which is kind of bizarre. So because I have a flat chest and a deep voice, I do now often go up for male roles.
Okay.
I have mixed feelings about that.
I mean, could that not also be because you're a good actress?
Well, I mean, yeah, I have played men. Yeah. I have, and I have to tell you, it's a very, very liberating experience, and I really enjoy it. But at the same time, it has to be right. And I have been up for certain jobs where I've gone, I don't understand why this part has suddenly is being played by a woman. You know, all of this is right. All of these kind of, you know, and diversity casting is right and all of that. But I think it's just about making sure it works in the world of the play or the TV series or whatever it is, rather than it just being, oh, look, you are now doing this for, you know, women, or we're now doing this for, you know, people of colour, you know, which I don't.
So you wouldn't agree, you wouldn't agree with quotas, because in sport,
no, I don't.
South
I'm
African
afraid.
Sport, there are quotas. And of course, in the last couple of years, in comedy panel shows in this country, they've said, oh, well, there needs to be one woman on each panel. I mean, isn't that just, though, potentially a starting point?
I guess it is. I mean, when I say, no, I don't agree with the quotas, maybe it is. It's kind of a sad thing that we even have to have that in built, isn't it? I mean, why isn't it just like, it just is a natural thing that happens? But maybe you're right. Maybe we do have to, you know, have that to remind people that this is an important start, as you say, a starting point and a way forward. So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting time, and I'm somebody that when I go to meet people for a job, I always audition them in my head, and it's something that I started to do because it took away the nerves a little bit. And so I always sit in a meeting going, well, do I want to work with you? Because I think that just empowers you as an actor a bit more. And Yeah, so I do try to look at the whole project and go, is this something, A, I want to be involved with? Is this going to work? Mm. You know, I'm not saying I'm always right, because I think I've turned stuff down and then it's been absolutely brilliant. And I'm like, oh, damn. But, I just think it's just really important for actors to do that, to kind of just take a step back rather than just being 100% grateful that somebody has given them a job.
Yeah.
You know, to make sure that you are involved in things that are happening for the right reasons.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Yeah.
Well, we've just completed our quota of good politic
in this. There we go.
I wanted to ask about, again, just getting into your dad's level of fame and then you following into acting and therefore potentially opening yourself up to the possibility of being in the public eye yourself.
Mm.
Do you feel like that's something that a decision that was kind of made for you because of your inbuilt want to be an actor, or did you get into it despite everything you'd seen, your dad being stopped on the street, that kind of stuff, press intrusion, that kind of thing?
I couldn't have been anything but an actor. I think that's the thing. You know, I did toy with other ideas, but ultimately, you know, I was always going to do that. I didn't go into it because I wanted to be famous. I'm doing a lot of speech marks there because, no, that's not important to me. And thank goodness, even now, especially now, it's such a kind of dangerous game to play, I think. I just went into it because I had no choice. It was the only thing that was going to make me happy. I was very aware in the early days after drama school, you know, I did get press attention because I was the daughter of Richard Briers. So, you know, whatever job I was doing, and I did a lot of repertory theatre, you know, the local paper would be like, you know, it's the good life for Lucy and all of that. And that's all fine. And was obviously good publicity for whatever show I was doing. But I did get to a point where I think after about 3-4 years, I would say to my agent, I don't really want to do this anymore, because otherwise I am always just going to be Lucy Briers, the daughter of Richard Briers, and I don't want that. And I was very careful about the jobs I took as well, because when I left drama school, I did a lot of sitcom and I started to, and I love sitcom. I love, love, love that genre, that weird thing where you're performing for the cameras, but you're also performing to a live audience. I just get a kick out of that. But I realised that, well, I not realised, but I suspected that I was almost being sort of slightly groomed. And I just thought, well, I'm going to be less funny and I don't want to do that because Dad was a one-off. So I very deliberately turned my back on that and went off and did about 10 years of repertory theatre, doing kind of crazy new plays and Shakespeare and all of that. And my dad was very cross with me for doing that, you know, because he knew that that was going to make my path more difficult. Right. But I always wanted to be able to look myself in the mirror and go, whatever you've achieved by your own merit, not by the fact that you are the daughter of a famous actor. Yeah. And that was really important to me.
It's a very common theme amongst our guests, some of whom even changed their surnames.
Yeah, I thought about that, but then I kind of went, well, no, it's my surname, so why should I?
Yeah.
You know, I auditioned for a film that Ken Branagh made called In the Bleak Midwinter, which was about a troupe of actors doing, it's a beautiful film, doing a production of Hamlet. And I got quite far into possibly playing opposite Michael Maloney as his romantic interest. And then I didn't get it. And Ken very sweetly said to me, oh, but, you know, look, I'd love you to be in this. So there's a couple of parts at the beginning of the film, which was literally like, you know, one line. And I said, I can't do it, because what that will look like is that I can't get a job. And because my dad was in the film, and you have given me this as a sort of sympathetic, you know, like, oh, bless her, you know, we'll give her one line in the film. You know? And I didn't do it because, I had to be careful like that, that I was never associated with him. I worked with him and my mum once. We did a play down in Southampton, but that was me co-producing. It was a brand new play. It was something that no one would have ever cast us in. Yeah. So I did that very deliberately as well.
And do you think, or have you ever been subject of accusations of nepotism? Is it anything you've ever heard to your face and had to deal with?
No, I'm sure when I first started out, I'm sure there were people going, oh, well, you know, she's going to have a very easy path through this. And I probably could have had an easier path if I had kind of gone unashamedly, let's just, you know, use all my father's contacts. But I sometimes I must say, I go, oh, it would have been easier. Yeah. It might have been easier. But I don't regret that. No, I don't think so. And I have taken a very, very different path in terms of what I've done. So, no, I don't think never happened to my face.
I've kind of asked that question to pretty much all of our guests, and the common theme is that a lot of that fear of people thinking like that, a lot of it is so in everybody's heads that the reality of it is probably not nearly as happening as you think it is.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
You've said before that you and your father both have the same stamina, bloody-mindedness and amazing talent for whinging, which made me laugh. Can you remember things specifically that you both had in common in terms of what you felt bloody-minded and whingy about, I wondered?
Oh, gosh, I can whinge about anything, to be frank.
You don't come across as whingy.
I think I'm slightly more positive these days. I've done a lot of mindfulness.
Who hasn't? It's 2019.
Come on. I am, actually. I'm much more about the attitude of gratitude these days.
The attitude of gratitude.
Indeed.
Well, there's my new Tinder bio sorted.
I do this thing. It's a bit hokey, but I do this thing at the end of every day and the beginning of every day. I will just wake up and go, what am I grateful for? And I will, when I go to bed, I go, what have I been grateful for today? And
it's nice.
It is good, because I am a glass half empty kind of person. I'm quite doer, as my father was. I don't like collective happiness. So I don't like festivals, or I find all of that very difficult.
Okay.
I like winter. Mm-hmm. I like autumn. I like darkness. I like quiet. I'm actually quite dull. My father was quite melancholic.
Yeah.
I think I veer towards that way as well. I mean, when I say amazing talent for whinging, my father was the champion of comedy whinging. So he did whinge, but it was in such a funny way. You know, it was kind of hilarious. I just whinge.
Was it kind of similar? So I'd say David Mitchell is particularly good at that in the modern generation of
absolutely.
Comics, where his kind of faux rants on things.
Yes.
Similar to that?
Absolutely. And what else did we have in common? Yeah, both very focused, goal-focused, I suppose. Work-focused. I'm very work-focused, always have been. And stamina. Yeah, well, my dad had much more stamina than I think I have. I mean, if you think about the fact he did all through my childhood, he would do a West End play every year. So 17 or 18 West End plays. The minimum run of one of those was 6 months, maximum nine, eight shows a week. Mm-hmm. I think he did his back in one show and he had like a week off. But I mean, I've done long, long runs of shows and, oh my goodness, I don't know. And then he would also for maybe 6-7 weeks of one of those contracts, a couple of times during one of those contracts, be recording a TV show. So no, he had way more stamina than me. I'm all right, but no, he had kind of championship stamina.
Yeah. So just some of the things you mentioned that you and your dad had in common, melancholia.
Yeah.
And things you talked about, loving the winter and the dark and stuff. I mean, these are quite common signs of depression to some degree. And I'm not saying that... Well, what I say is, that, you know, I'd say I suffer from a bit of depression at times myself. And I have those things in common as well. And we previously talked about how your dad was an artist. And obviously you followed in an artistic way into that. Do you think those things come hand in hand a lot of ways? And that's what leads us into the career decisions we make, because that creativity is important to us to...
Yes.
Balance out those negatives sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I would not call myself a depressive, very luckily. I've only ever been, this is a very kind of open fact I'm going to share now, because I think people should talk about these things, but the only time I have actually had a period of depression was after I had a miscarriage.
Right.
So, you know, that is when I went, oh, everything is ashes, nothing means anything. So I understand to a degree what being suffering from depression is like. I don't know that my father, it's very difficult. He was a very private person, so he may well have had periods of depression that I wasn't aware of. But because he was consistently and constantly working, he probably, he used that to sort of stave it off. And because of the type of man my father was and the generation he came from, you know, he would have just said, oh, well, I just have to buck up. You know, he'd have never gone to a counsellor, or I'm absolutely, you know, just not, never do that. So, yeah, I think it is a necessary side to most actors, artists, to have that darker side and to be able to sit in that and understand that. Because then how are you going to play?
Yeah, helps you into
all
roles.
All those different roles, you know, you're not, you know. So, yeah, it's a price I think most creatives pay, really. Yeah.
I wonder how your dad, you think your dad might have been different if he wasn't famous, and how it would have affected your life. God, have you ever had any thoughts on that?
Oh my God, no. What, if he'd still been an actor?
Yeah, why not?
I think as long as my dad had made enough money as an actor, he would have been very happy to do that. I don't, as I've said before, the fame aspect of it was not something he had gone into the profession to chase. It just happened because of the various shows he did. Yeah, I think as long as he'd felt that he could provide for his family, he would have been happy. If he'd been an actor who hadn't been able to do that, I think our lives would have been a lot tougher. A lot tougher, you know, because he wouldn't have felt fulfilled. He would have felt that he'd failed as a father and as an actor. And yeah, I think that would have been super difficult, because he always said to me, there's nothing else I could ever have done. There's nothing else I could ever have done. And I don't mean that in, like I've said it earlier, there was nothing else I wanted to do. But I think I'm kind of a bit more diverse in the fact that, you know, I run workshops, I do other things, I'm learning to be a hands-on healer at the moment, you know, all that kind of stuff. I have other interests. My father just was literally like, I have no other interest. This is it. So I think if it hadn't worked out, that would have been quite a tough family scenario.
I really envy that in some ways, that knowledge of the one thing you're so passionate about that you have to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm kind of envious of that, because over the years of my career, I've found myself, you know, lots of different fingers in different pies. I actually did an interview for a TV job once, where the guy said, "You don't get a lot of interviews, do you?" And I said, "Actually, do you know what? I don't." He said, "That's because people want to pigeonhole you, and you've done so many different things that they don't know how to fit you into their box."
That's so true. I remember doing an audition, and this director looked down my CV and he went, "Gosh, you play a lot of different types of roles, don't you?" And I went, "Well, isn't that what being an actor is?" And he just looked at me like I sort of said something completely incomprehensible. No, everybody wants to just go, you know, Barnaby does this, Lucy does that, and then it's easy. But yeah.
I saw an interview though with your dad where he talked about how a lot of his early roles he felt he was playing a version of himself. He certainly was talked about playing Tom Good.
Yeah.
And how basically it was, you know, someone trying so hard to get everything right that he ends up getting it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
Yeah, no, I think...
And then he obviously branched out, you know,
yeah,
later
but
on.
I think, of course, there's always going to be aspects of yourself in every part you play because you're going to be drawing on those. I always like look at a role and I go, right, what is similar in my personality to this role? And then, obviously, what is different? And that's what I have to kind of go away and research and really think about. But there's always going to be aspects that you use from yourself, definitely.
I'm actually the world's most terrible actor. I've tried
Are
to do
you?
Some acting in time. Yeah, because when I was doing stand-up comedy, and you get an agent, you automatically get put up for acting roles.
Of course, yes.
And every time I was in any of those auditions or whatever, I just felt so in the wrong place. So I think the only way it would ever work for me is if the role, you know, it was a character who was just 100% sarcastic the whole time.
Brilliant.
And otherwise, I couldn't do it. What is the most embarrassing moment or strange anecdote that you can think of from as a result of growing up around fame?
I feel like
there's something there. There's something there.
There is, but it's such a silly story. But I always remember this, and it's not. It wasn't very embarrassing, but it kind of was. We were on our way to. For about 3 or 4 years, every summer, my parents would rent this little cottage in Cornwall. And we were driving down there in my dad's kind of Morris something or other, Morris Minor or something. And we got stuck in a traffic jam or something in the middle of a kind of market town. That's all I remember. And it was very hot. And the dog was in the back and all that, you know. And we got stuck. And this woman walked past the car and did a double take at my dad. And I say it was hot, but for some reason the window was up. It's, again, my father going, no, that's why. I don't know why. Anyway, the window was up.
Was it the hot summer of 76 that everyone
probably,
talks about?
No, we didn't go to Cornwall that year. bizarrely, I can remember that. But so anyway, she knocked on the window. My father probably opened the window more. Anyway, and he knew what was coming. And we all went, oh, here we go. You know, yes, hello. Yes, you can have an autograph. Lovely, you know, whatever. My father was always incredibly polite to everybody who asked for an autograph because he used to say to us, these are the people that keep me where I am. You know, if I'm rude to my fans, then I'm just being a hideous person, which is quite right, you know. And anyway, this woman knocked on the window. He wound the window down and she went, you're Paul Eddington, aren't you? And he just wound the window back up. And it's the only time I ever saw my dad be rude, or kind of rude, or non-committal to a fan, because he was, and I just thought, oh, that's hilarious. I was probably only about 8 or 9 or something. But it's not really embarrassing.
Paul Eddington was Eddington was the other character in The Good Life.
Indeed,
who I read that your dad got him the job in that, I read. He suggested him for it anyway.
I think he did, yeah. But I think both, all of them, Felicity Kendall, Penelope Keith and Paul Eddington were all in either one or two Alan Ayckbourn plays that were on in the West End at the time of casting for The Good Life. And I think Dad saw Paul in something and just went, he's brilliant. And they became lifelong friends. I mean, they were very, very good friends.
I was definitely in I can't remember, I think it was a bar with my stepdad, Angus Deaton, and someone came up to him and said, you're Nicholas Witchell, aren't you?
Which if you and what see, did Angus do?
Oh, I don't think. I mean, an arch eyebrow raise.
He doesn't look anything like him.
No, if you look at Nicholas Witchell now and don't think of Nicholas Witchell from the 80s, there is a similarity.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, didn't go down overly
but
well.
But Angus is much better known, isn't he?
Well, I guess it depends. In comedy and acting world, probably, but in terms of people who've watched the 6 o'clock news all
that's
their
true.
Life.
That's
and,
true.
And love the royals, because he's now
yes,
the royal correspondent,
right.
isn't
yes,
he?
Yes, yes, yes.
I wonder if you feel your acting has been in any way influenced by your dad's, or your mum's, for that matter.
I mean, the thing is, I look a bit like my dad, which is really annoying because my mum looked like Audrey Hepburn when she was younger. I was always like, thanks, great, thanks for those lack of genes, mum. I'm very aware of that, and I'm still aware of that.
I read, I think in an article that you'd been interviewed or something. I certainly read somewhere that someone said that you look like your dad, and I hadn't immediately thought
of
that.
It's the lower part of my face. It's when I smile. I have his smile.
Right.
I definitely have certain mannerisms of his that I couldn't kind of actually identify myself, but people have said, you know, you do have mannerisms. Of course I do.
Yeah.
You know. I think if I'm looking, you know, if I'm having a problem with a character, I will think about how would Dad get out of this potentially. It's funny. I don't refer to my mum as much as an actor because, you know, she really didn't do that much work from when I was kind of conscious of it. What was wonderful was when we did the play together and they played my parents. It was fantastic to actually be on stage with my mum and kind of go, oh my goodness, okay. You know, and she was an excellent actress, you know. And so, yeah, I didn't really get that until much later on in my life. But yeah, Dad is a reference sometimes. I will think, well, how would he say this line or how would he, yeah. You know. But
That feels like a what a reference to have. That
yeah.
feels like a great archive to call upon, you know?
Mm. Absolutely, no. Not bad.
Your dad once admitted that he enjoyed being recognised, saying, I'm gregarious by nature, so love chatting to people. It really cheers me up. Is that level of fame something you ever aspired to? I don't get the feeling that it was.
No.
You just acted because you loved acting.
Yeah, I never thought about that aspect of things. I mean, I will hilariously, not so much now, but I used to get recognised regularly for Pride and Prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I played Mary Bennett, who was like, and again, I'm putting the speech marks, the plain sister, I would always get recognised if I'd gone out without any makeup on, which I thought was quite hilarious.
Would they say, you're Paul Eddington?
Yeah, you're Paul Eddington on you. And that was very pleasant, you know. But, I mean...
Was it pleasant? So you felt comfortable?
Absolutely, because I would just go into how I'd seen my dad behave with people who ask for autographs. And I will do exactly the same if I'm in a show in the West End and anyone asks for my autograph at the stage door afterwards. Of course, you're just pleasant and you say thanks for seeing the show because, yeah, they're absolutely. You know, I have a couple of friends of mine who are sort of film star fame level. I would in no way want that level of attention. They all cope with it extremely well in different ways. I always say I wouldn't mind the bank account, that you know, but I would not want that level of attention. Certain friends of ours who are based in LA, one of them went through a phase of being super well-known, and there was always a sort of battered old, you know, Mustang outside their house with a guy paparazzi in. And I just think, how horrific. Yeah. You know, you can't just go, oh, I'll just pop around the corner for a, you know, you have to kind of like put, I don't know, full makeup on or look really great or whatever. So, yeah, that, oh, God, no. I'm happy to occasionally be recognised for, you know, like, oh, you played Mary Bennett in 1843 and I go, thanks very much and lovely, you know.
And because of the tabloids and the paparazzi, a lot of people who grew up in famous families have had to deal with a lot of lies being written about them. I wonder if that's something you've ever had to deal with.
No, really, the only thing, I had a kind of really annoying thing that happened where I'd been a bit sort of careless in an interview when I was doing Pride and Prejudice, actually. And my ex-husband proposed to me while we were driving down the A4. You know, it's not romantic, but kind of is romantic because it's not all kind of, you know, stage managed. And I said,
literally driving, or did you pull over?
No, he was driving and we were just having a chat and he just went, oh, you know, I think we should get married. And I was like, oh, okay, great. So I kind of said this in an interview and he didn't have a ring or anything, you know. He knew me well enough that he knew that I would have to design the ring, and because I'm quite controlling about things like that.
Sing the theme tune.
Exactly, you know. So, and then it was put into a nasty little sort of tiny little thing in the gossip pages of, I don't know, the Daily Mail or something. You know, it said Lucy Briers on the A4 without a diamond. And my ex-husband got incredibly upset by that, and quite rightly so, you know. And that taught me a lesson. But it's also that awful thing of things being kind of twisted. Fortunately, my dad had such an image that nobody, I think, even if my father had, you know, been... for goodness sake, what's the name of the character that Bryan Cranston plays in Breaking Bad?
Walter White.
Even if my father had been Walter White, running a sort of crystal meth business in his shed,
I'd have still wanted you as a guest, just so you know. I'd have definitely still wanted you as a guest.
Nobody would have, even if there'd been evidence. I just think my father, very wonderfully, was so well-liked that I don't think people would have run a story. You know, I don't know. I was very lucky in that respect.
Yeah.
You know, that he was just, and also there was just fortunately nothing, I don't know, there was nothing to be lied about or made up, or he just didn't attract that kind of journalism.
Yeah,
which is great.
And what comes across and has come across, it's a really common theme amongst people I've interviewed for this show, is that their famous family member, be it father, mother, or sibling, seems to always be our guest's hero. Always, like, really, and this comes across with you as well.
Yeah, although I hate the word hero.
Okay. Tell me what you'd have preferred.
The reason I hate it is I think it's overused, like the word star. Hmm. You know, I just think it's also like that dreadful politician phrase, isn't it? Thoughts and prayers. You know, a hero to me is a firefighter or somebody who saves lives or a paramedic.
But isn't it different when it's somebody's hero rather than just being a hero?
Maybe.
Like, I guess I just mean aspiration. Aspirational and just that depth of love, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think for me, he was somebody who I always looked up to and still do in terms of going, well, what would he do or how would he handle the situation? And I looked up to him and respected him hugely for his work ethic and how he approached what happened to him in his career and all of that. But yeah, I would never say hero. To me, that's just a bit mawkish. I don't know. It's just a bit. Just turns your dad into something that he's not, in a way.
We did ask your agent if there was anything you didn't want to say. If you could have just come back with the word hero, then that would have helped me out a great deal.
I'm so sorry. I'm so, so sorry.
You mentioned your ex-husband, so you've really been married. I wondered if growing up around fame has in any way you think affected your personal relationships or seeing, you know, you talk about your dad in such amazing ways. I wonder if that made it difficult for men in particular or relationships in particular to aspire to live up to.
It probably did, actually. Yeah, I think it probably was, and quite an odd household to become a part of. You know, my family were very much a kind of like, we all sat around the dinner table, slightly raised voices, you know, shouting about what our opinions were, not in an aggressive way, that was just how we communicated with each other. And my ex-husband came from a much quieter, more intellectual family, and that was as much a shock for me as for him, you know, vice versa. So I'd go for dinner and go, oh my God, I felt so
intimidating.
Sort of like intimidated and inhibited. And I think he did for the opposite reasons. Yeah, I think if you have a father-in-law who had that kind of standing, that was probably quite a difficult thing to balance in one's life. My partner now, who I've been with for nearly 13 years, he and my dad got on probably the best out of any person that I've had a long-term relationship with. And they just have a sort of similar, I don't know, sort of quite dark Irish, because there's a lot of Irish blood in my father's side of the family. There's a lot of Irish blood in my partner's, and they just clicked. And so I think my partner didn't feel that. And also, by the time he met me, Dad was not in that kind of massively high point of his career. He was already sort of starting to slow down. So probably not as intimidating, but...
And presumably got to spend more time with him than maybe he would have done.
Yeah, well, we even lived with my parents because I had so much work done to the flat I just bought. We had to move out. So we lived with my parents for 3 months, like in our early 40s. It was hilarious. And
That's
my partner,
a sitcom, if ever I've
it
heard
is it. A real sitcom. And my partner's a brilliant cook, so he would do a lot of the cooking. And yeah, no, that was actually a really great thing for him, again, to sort of just know who my parents were and know who my dad was on a day-to-day basis. You know, I think when I was younger, I would be a little bit wary of why people wanted to be friends with me.
Yeah,
there would be, again, when Dad was, you know, at his peak of fame, I'd be a little bit like, oh, okay, why are you sniffing around? You know, you do have to choose your friends carefully, I think, and hang on to the people who are loyal to you as well. I never understand that thing that happens where you see actors who suddenly become incredibly famous and some people drop all the friends they've had.
They only start hanging out with famous people.
What are you doing? And you go, no, 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 please hang on to those people because they're your real friends who were kind of there helping you do your self-tapes and doing, you know, before you became a huge Hollywood star or whatever. The friends I have who are very famous have very sensibly done that. They've hung on to all the people who they were at school with, who are friends. You know, that's how you deal with it, and that's how you do it. So, yeah. But again, my father was not Robert Redford. You know, it wasn't that level of fame. Yeah. So,
but once again, if he had been, I'd still be interested in interviewing you.
That's very kind.
One final question that
we
ask.
I might have better bone structure as well.
There's been a lot of self-deprecating stuff about how you
look. That's my dad in me.
Not that delighted with that, to be honest. Yeah, one final question we ask everyone. I feel like I know what the answer is going to be.
Okay.
If you could live your life all over again, but without having had a famous father, would you swap?
Would I still have my father?
Yes, but he wouldn't have been famous.
I think I'd go back to when I said, as long as he'd been successful
enough for them enough financially.
Absolutely. But if he hadn't been, no, I wouldn't swap.
Love the honesty. Lucy, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been really fun. Lovely, lovely chat. You've been so open, actually. And
I hope I haven't been too open, Barnaby.
No, I personally don't think so. You
were,
you'd said before that you were worried about being indiscreet. I mean, a little bit more indiscretion might have gone a long way.
Soz.
But maybe next time on the bonus features that we will never air. Thanks for coming on the show. And for you guys for listening to this episode of Almost Famous, please do press that subscribe button. We'd love for you to listen to every single episode if possible. And if you could leave a comment in the comments box too, ideally positive, but you know, it's all good for helping us up that algorithm.
I never read reviews, so that's good.
Yep, so Lucy won't be reading. I will be reading, but I see it all as, you know, positivity, even if you're being abusive. Find us on Instagram at Almost Famous the Podcast and on Twitter at Pod Almost Famous. And until next time, thank you so much for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.